From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
For more than a decade, there has been widespread illegal use of anabolic steroids and other performance-enhancing substances by players in Major League Baseball, in violation of federal law and baseball policy.
On Thursday, George Mitchell released the results of his 20-month investigation into steroid abuse in Major League Baseball. Ahead on Only a Game, we'll discuss the impact the report will have on the game. Also, the Miami Dolphins go for a perfect season while their AFC rivals, the Jets, look to avoid a perfect slaughter against the perfect Patriots. And coming up, hang on to your stockings and say your prayers, because the 15th annual Only a Game Sports Holiday Gift Guide comes right now. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Thursday, George Mitchell released his committee's report detailing the results of a 20-month investigation into performance-enhancing drugs in Major League Baseball. One of his conclusions was that there is plenty of blame to go around.
Everyone involved in baseball over the past two decades, commissioners, club officials, the Players Association, the players, shares to some extent in the responsibility for the steroids era. There was a collective failure to recognize the problem as it emerged and to deal with it early on. As a result, an environment developed in which illegal use became widespread.
The Mitchell Report included the names of over 80 current or former Major League ballplayers implicated in the use of steroids or human growth hormone. The committee got much of their information from former New York Mets clubhouse employee Kirk Radomski, who said he provided steroids to players, and strength and conditioning trainer Brian McNamee, who claimed he injected several players with steroids. Radomski is in jail, and McNamee is waiting to learn whether he will face federal drug distribution charges, circumstances that led Donald Fehr, the head of the players' union, to caution against taking those witnesses at their word.
In my view, anyone interested in fairly assessing the allegations against a player should consider the nature of the evidence presented, the reliability of the source.
At one point in Thursday's news conference, Mr. Mitchell seemed to be speaking to the charge that his committee had depended on witnesses with something to gain by telling the authorities what they wanted to hear.
Each of the players was invited to meet with me so I could provide him with information about the allegations and give him an opportunity to respond. Almost without exception, all current players declined my invitation and refused to meet or to talk with me.
In declining that invitation, the players were following the advice they'd received from the Players Association. Joining me now to discuss the Mitchell Report and what's likely to follow from it is ESPN's Buster Olney. Buster, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
On Thursday, Mr. Mitchell urged people to look beyond the players named in the report, but of course much of the conversation has been about those players, one of whom is Roger Clemens. Clemens' agent has said that the pitcher has been slandered. Does he have a point?
Well, you know, we'll see if he follows this up with some sort of a lawsuit, but the reality is that this will affect him forever. There's no question when you look at the specific information that's in the report tied to names, there are many situations where you look at that evidence and you'd say, wow, that's pretty thin. And, you know, in talking with people in baseball and management and agents yesterday after the report came out, you know, the word that they used was McCarthyism. They felt like that in some cases that there were just names thrown out there based on, you know, hearsay and a list. But at the same time, there's no question that there are probably cases where there's more information than others. And you know, we'll see how strongly Roger defends himself in court.
If Clemens and the other players named had taken advantage of the opportunity to speak with Mr. Mitchell, do you think the report would have been more balanced, or did those players have nothing to gain by participating in the process and everything to lose?
They had very little to gain, and they had a lot to lose because, of course, these are people, when you're talking about Kirk Radomski, the former Mets bat boy, and Brian McNamee, you're talking about people who've been pressured during federal investigations, and any lawyer worth his salt is going to tell a player, look, you can't go in there. because you don't control that process. And on top of, I mean, there are a lot of questions raised about how the information was gathered. For instance, there were no transcripts of any of the conversations that took place. I know of an instance of from an agent of one former player who was told, look, you know, we have information tying you with this former Mets bat boy, and he was livid. The player was livid, and so he said, you know what, I want to see the information you have. Sure, I'm going to meet with you. And when he went in there, he had a copy of a check of $150 was shown to him, and he said, and he was asked the question, do you know where that check came from? His response was, I don't know where it came from, but I can tell you what, it could have been for pizza, it could have been for McDonald's run, for the players, it could have been for any number of things, but I can tell you it wasn't for drugs. And they went back to Rademski at that point, and Rademski, according to the agent, acknowledged he didn't know where precisely what it was for. Mm. And there are a lot of those type of examples you're hearing on, you know, the player side, and we really haven't heard from the player side because, of course, they didn't have access to the report until 1 o'clock yesterday.
What do you suppose the mechanism will be by which we do hear from the players or the player's side?
There's no question that I think that we're going to start hearing from players named in the report where they're going to give greater context than what is in the report. For instance, Brian Roberts, the second baseman for the Orioles, the one piece of evidence that's cited, and I don't even know if you call it evidence, is a former teammate of his recalled to investigators that Brian Roberts mentioned to him once or twice he took steroids. And, you know, it's situations like that where I think the agents or, you know, are going to say some things. And I think at some point Don Fehr, the leader of the Player Association, is going to come out and challenge the way in which a lot of this information was gathered. And I know from talking with people on the union side, you know, they've had questions about that stuff for, you know, the better part of a year, and they were curious to see, with great fear, quite frankly, about what was going to be in the report. And in talking with agents last night, their fears were realized.
Given that George Mitchell's aims were to demonstrate that the use of illegal performance enhancers has been common in Major League Baseball and to urge players, ball clubs, owners, and the commissioner to create a healthier environment within the game, did he have to name names?
That's one of the great questions that's being asked. And what's interesting about it is he's been given credit for, you know, drawing a broad analysis of what took place. And he gave us specific names of players who use steroids, but he absolutely did not give us names on the management side or in the union leadership and make particular recommendations or particular observations about people making mistakes. In other words, there's nothing in the report about specifically what he views Bud Selig to have done wrong. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in the report about what he specifically believes the union leadership to have done wrong and how it helped to create the culture that existed. You know, so in that regard, that was a little surprising to me. I thought there would be more about accountability for what had taken place.
Mr. Mitchell has said that punishment should be reserved for players who have compromised the integrity of the game. This suggests to me a kind of relative understanding of integrity.
Yeah.
What would a player have to do beyond breaking baseball's rules and the law by using prescription drugs without a legitimate prescription in order to compromise the game's integrity?
You're right, and maybe his standard, and he didn't really elaborate on that, maybe his standard is using drugs after baseball put in its testing system with penalties, which really didn't begin until 2004. You know, maybe that's it. I agree with you, and along the same lines, again, to keep the whole broader thing in context, you know, were the decisions by people at the top of the union and by owners and by people in baseball management, you know, were they in the best interest of baseball in the 90s when they effectively made choices not to pursue what was a lot of clues that there was a growing problem?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, was that not in the best interest of the sport either?
Despite Mr. Mitchell's opinion that punishment of particular players should not be the commissioner's focus at this time, Bud Selig has announced that he will act. We're not sure what that means, but what do you anticipate the commissioner will do?
I think he's going to look at the context of what the evidence that's in the report, and if in those cases in which he feels he has evidence of violations during those times when there was a penalty phase. In other words, if according to the Mitchell report evidence, you violated the terms of the baseball agreement in 2004 or 2005, 2006, 2007, the last four seasons, I think he will try to apply baseball standard for a first positive test based on that analytical or non-analytical evidence.
Regarding Mr. Mitchell's injunction that everybody's focus should be on the future rather than the past, do you suppose that somewhere Mark McGuire, who said the same thing 2 years ago during a congressional hearing, is smiling?
He certainly should be. And I don't know if Mark McGuire is smiling, but I do think, or Barry Bonds for that matter, but I do think as that more and more names come out, that we do get just a small slice into the broader context of what this problem was. I mean, think about it. We only got, I think the last count that we had at ESPN was 86 names in the most recent report. You know, that represents between 1% and 2% of all the players who appeared in games from 1995 forward. And most people in the game think that the problem involved 30 to 40, maybe 50% of the players at its height in 2000-2002. So if you're Mark McGuire, not only was that remark by Mitchell make you smile, but I think the evidence coming out to let people know, look, it wasn't just these two or three. It wasn't just McGuire or Bonds or Jason Giambi. It involved a whole lot of people.
One final question, and maybe this should have been my first question. Mr. Mitchell has various ties to Major League Baseball himself. Of course, he was hired by Major League Baseball to investigate Major League Baseball. Does this circumstance call into question the legitimacy of the report?
It did, certainly, during the report. You heard that a lot from baseball executives. I think in light of the information that came out and the fact that there are people named on every team, and, of course, George Mitchell's member of the Red Sox, you know, in the aftermath of the report, there's no question. There are people within the Yankee organization, I think, who are going, wait a second, we got absolutely crushed, and the Red Sox were just touched a few times. I personally don't think there's much to that. I think that's based on the fact that the two main characters, or the two main sources of information, were guys who were in New York, so that's going to be natural. But I do think that as people look more at the evidence, that those questions will continue to hover over the report, which is, did baseball essentially get what it paid for, despite the advance notice that leaked out of the commissioner's office a day ahead that baseball, got really hit hard in this report? They really didn't. Bud Selig certainly did not get hit hard in the final report. There were no specific criticisms of how he acted. And I think as time goes on and people absorb all of the information in the report, they'll say, was this kind of an inside job?
Buster only writes about baseball for ESPN. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Retired Formula One racing champion Michael Schumacher briefly unretired recently. As he and his family were motoring toward an airport in Berlin, Schumacher realized that they might not make their flight. He politely asked the cab driver to switch seats, slid behind the wheel, and, well, raced to his destination. "It was crazy having Schumi driving with me in the passenger seat," said the delighted cabbie, who was even more delighted when Mr. Schumacher gave him a 100-euro tip for the 60-euro fare. Though the plane the Schumacher family caught was briefly delayed, there is no truth to the rumor that Mr. Schumacher tried to drive that to. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a mirthful Mangini getting to Jets fans everywhere. But first, they tell me SeaWorld's dolphins are a happy, playful lot. The ones now playing football in Miami? Probably not. They've lost in every way. A bad team possibly can do it. 3 games remain this season. They'll be happy to get through it. The Miami Dolphins hope not to continue their perfectly winless season tomorrow against Baltimore. Joining me now on the line to talk about Miami's flippered futility is Armando Salguero, who has covered the Dolphins since 1990. Armando, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, and thanks for the poetry recital.
I appreciate your calling it poetry. Most people call it doggerel, and by golly, they're right. But anyway, the Dolphins are 0-13. What's it been like to cover this team?
Well, it's not fun, obviously. This is a team that is on the verge of infamy. There is no team that has ever lost all 16 of its regular season games, as many of your listeners know. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers in 1976 lost all 14 of their games. But that was an expansion team, a team that was brought together with guys from, basically the street. And that was a first-year fledgling team. This team has been together for 40 years, is celebrating even this week the 35-year anniversary of that perfect 17-0 season. And yet, during that 35-year anniversary, they're on the verge of the worst season in the history of the NFL.
You host a daily radio show dedicated to Dolphins talk. What are the people in Florida saying about these wayward aquatic mammals?
Well, basically, I host a show that has become, refereeing a mob that comes up to the castle with torches and pitchforks and wants the heads of every single player, coach, personnel director that the Miami Dolphins employ. That's the level of frustration down here in South Florida.
Are any of the Dolphins saying things like, we're better than our record indicates?
Yes, and what a surprise, right?
They could hardly be worse.
That's true. They have, in fact, lost six games by 3 points or less. But what is depressing is that this bad team, which was bad to begin with, is now regressing. The last 2 weeks in second-chance meetings against division opponents, they got blown out by both the Buffalo Bills and the New York Jets after, playing both teams close in their first meetings. And so they're getting a lot worse, which is hard to do when you're winless.
Is there any beacon of hope in this otherwise bleak season?
Absolutely. And the hope is that it will end. I mean, it will not go on indefinitely. And so there is an end point, and we will reach it, no doubt about that. We are, marching inexorably toward that mark, and hopefully it comes sooner than later.
Of course, I guess they have to hope that, unlike that Tampa Bay team to which you referred a moment ago, they won't continue to lose into next season. Tampa Bay's streak covered almost two complete seasons.
Yeah, the Dolphins have already celebrated a one-year anniversary of winlessness. They did not win their final three games last season. Look, their big hope right now is that they have three games left and that they can manage somehow, some way, that God shines his good graces down on them and they win a game. That is their hope. Unfortunately, I don't know that that will happen.
You mentioned that the fans were angry at everybody from the owner to the player personnel director to the coach, et cetera, but from your perspective, how did this team get so bad?
It's been 5-6 years in the making. The Dolphins don't have any players on the roster today from drafts coming from 1998 through 2003. Mm-hmm. So that's basically five drafts that were supposed to feed the nucleus of this team that fed nothing. And so what we have is a team that is bereft of veteran leadership that is supposed to be in its prime. It has a couple of players that are very old, in their 12th and 10th seasons, respectively. And then it has the players who are very young. You know, the bunch of players that are feeding the New England Patriots or the Indianapolis Colts or other good teams are players that are in their prime, 25, 26, 27, 28 years old. The Dolphins don't have very many of those guys.
It would appear, based on past performance, as they say at the racetrack, that tomorrow's game against the Ravens would be the Dolphins' best chance to get that one win. Do you agree with Miami defensive lineman Vonnie Holiday when he says, we should win a ball game, you would think?
That's what he's told me on several occasions, and then days later they go out and lose. So the Baltimore Ravens are a challenged team as well. They've lost seven in a row, but they seem, at least from what I've seen of them, they seem to be a tougher team. They seem to be more stout than the Dolphins. They've got more speed than the Dolphins. And frankly, they have more talent than the Dolphins. And so you combine that with the fact that their coach just got a reprieve and was told by the owner that he will be back next year. Meanwhile, the coaching staff here is on pins and needles because they don't know what their future will hold. And it's not the recipe for an upset.
The Dolphins, of course, boast the last undefeated regular season team back in 1972. They will play AFC rival New England in Foxborough next weekend. That game will be irresistible, especially if the Patriots are still undefeated and Miami is still winless. How do you suppose fans will react if it ends 16-0 for the Pats, 0-16 for the Fish?
You know, obviously New England fans, their reaction prior to the game is, yippee! You know, bring it on, because the last time the two teams played, New England was leading 42-7 at halftime. And if you remember earlier, we discussed the regression factor, the Dolphins playing worse.
Oh, my God, 84-14?
Yeah, so can you imagine that? You know, and the Patriots are not by any means injured or have not suffered any significant setbacks. The Dolphins are limping in to their last three games. They've lost 11, 12 guys to injuries this year. If you're asking me if the improbable is going to happen, I would say probably not.
How do you figure the members of that 72 undefeated Dolphins team will react if their club is 0-16 and the Pats end up 16-0? Will heads explode?
Yeah, they're sick about it. I don't believe that members of the 72 team, having spoken to a sprinkling of them, really are upset that the Patriots have a chance to go undefeated. Their hearts are breaking because their team is winless, and not only winless, but three-ring circus clown winless. That hurts them, and, you know, it only increases the pain, the fact that their chief rivals are going for an undefeated season.
Armando Salguero chronicles Dolphins futility for the Miami Herald, ESPN, and he hosts a Dolphins call-in show every weeknight on 790 AM, The Ticket. Armando, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
They call him Flipper, Flipper, faster than lightning. No one you see is smarter than he.
I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org.
Ever so kind and gentle is he. Tricks he will do.
The Dolphins need only concern themselves with the 4-9 Baltimore Ravens tomorrow. The 3-10 Jets must gulp contend with the 13-0 Patriots, who are already mad at the Jets for ratting out the Pats when they illegally filmed New York at play earlier this season. Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor puts tomorrow's game in historical perspective.
Some historians say the typical Aztec human sacrifice ritual would start with the victim being led to a stone slab on top of a temple. Four priests would hold him down while a fifth would cut out the heart and place it, still beating, in a bowl next to the statue of the god being honored. Afterwards, the body would be thrown down the temple stairs and later fed to zoo animals. That's about what most observers think will happen to the New York Jets when they visit the New England Patriots tomorrow. Pats coach Bill Belichick clearly relishes his role as the angry Aztec war god, Huitzilopochtli.
It's a division game. They know us well. We know them well. And, you know, we're just going to try to do what we always do, which is win. You know, everything that's in the past is in the past. Everything that's in the future doesn't really matter. Right now, it's a one-game season. We're focused on the New York Jets.
Okay, so Belichick is not that threatening. Although you can't rule anything out during the post-game handshake with Jets head coach and former protege Eric Mangini. But the 3-10 Jets are very, very bad, and the undefeated Patriots are very, very good. Since the Cameragate story broke after the Patriots' Week 1 rout of the Jets, the Pats have destroyed most of their opponents with what may be the best offense in NFL history. New England fans like Craig Kaplan have pointed to this week's rematch as a candidate for the biggest rout the league has ever seen.
Let's just say 70-0. How's that? I think they're just going to walk up and down the field for the entire game. I don't even think it's... I'll see the highlights. That's all I really need to see.
A 70-point victory would still be 3 points shy of the record. That was set in the 1940 NFL Championship game in which the Chicago Bears brutalized the Washington Redskins 73-0. The two teams met 3 weeks earlier, and Washington won a controversial game. The Bears complained, and Redskins owner George Marshall called the Bears a bunch of crybabies and frontrunners. BearsHistory.com founder Roy Taylor says Chicago coach George Halas used the insults to rally his team.
It was ugly. It was bad for the Redskins. The Bears scored the first minute into the game, and it got so bad at the end of the game with the Bears up 63-0. They were actually asked not to kick any more extra points because they had lost all the game balls. There was only one ball left that hadn't been kicked into the stands.
Halas obviously had no problem with running up the score that day, but Taylor says the need to embarrass wasn't usually a top priority for Halas or any of his contemporaries.
You know, Halas and Marshall, they were founding owners of NFL teams, so obviously they had a strong relationship. You know, there might have been more of a gentlemanly aspect to the game, both at the owner's level and the player's level in 1940 than there is now. I'd say there's probably a little more bad blood between the Jets and the Patriots right now than there was between the Bears and the Redskins.
73-0 is bad, but some of the blowouts seen in the annals of college football have been much worse. The game between Georgia Tech and tiny Cumberland College in 1916 was never in doubt and ugly from the opening kickoff. Cumberland historian Dr. Frank Burns says the team had disbanded after four games in 1916, and the Tech game wouldn't have happened at all if it weren't for a cash guarantee and an enterprising team manager.
The week before, they had played Sewanee, which is the University of the South, and they had lost to Sewanee 100-0. So they weren't going to go down to Atlanta until they found out they'd have to pay $1,500 forfeit if they didn't. George Allen, who was a law student, and he went down to the fraternity house and he said, "Hey, how many of you want to go play football?"
14 Cumberland players did and headed to Atlanta to face a Georgia Tech squad coached by John Heisman, who would later have some obscure football trophy named after him. The score was 63-0 after the first quarter and 126-0 at the half. Cumberland gained minus 28 yards for the entire game, and Tech scored 12 defensive touchdowns. Quarterback Bud Patey had a horrible day with six interceptions, but during at least one fumble, he had the right idea.
He was the quarterback, and they snapped the ball, and it went past him, and the other back dropped it. The other back said to Patey, "Pick it up, pick it up," and Patey said, "Pick it up yourself, you dropped it."
Georgia Tech eased up in the second half, scoring only 96 points and cruising to a 222-point win. If the second half hadn't been cut short 15 minutes, things could have really gotten out of hand. Strangely enough, Burns says Cumberland has embraced its role as the school that lost a football game by over 200 points.
"Well, you can't fight it. You might as well get something out of it." So we began circulating stories to newspapers about it. We got to be kind of sort of proud of having lost 222-0. Nobody else could claim that. It was unique.
Maybe Eric Mangini can find some solace in that if the Patriots do set a record tomorrow. Someone had to ensure the plague of fire would not return to the Aztec Village, just like someone has to be the recipient of the worst loss in NFL history. Perhaps in 90 years, the Jets will be weirdly proud of that. For Only a Game, I'm Gabe O'Connor in Tenochtitlan. I mean, Boston.
You're listening to Only a Game. Why should a toddler take ski lessons? Commentator Susan Sabin recently thought of several good reasons for that and decided to share them with us.
My 4-year-old granddaughter, as limp as the mittens dangling from her parka, clutches my hand as we inch up a line towards ski lesson number 1. Behind us, a pair of brothers is duking it out. Another boy, screeching in protest, is getting a talking to. My granddaughter is obedient and quiet, but I notice furrow lines on her little forehead. What am I thinking? I guess I'm thinking of myself, of opportunities missed, of advantages I manage without, but which I have in my power to give. There is a window of opportunity for certain kinds of learning that slams shut when you reach a certain age, and 4 is a good time to learn to ski, old enough to be coordinated, young enough to be low to the ground. Although those are reasons my granddaughter can learn to ski, not reasons I want her to, I see the two as related. Having come to athletics late in life, I know the difficulty of overcoming fears and the challenges of teaching old neurons new tricks. I discovered sports through bicycling. On Martha's Vineyard with friends at age 22, I was pressured into trying my first two-wheeler. I attribute my success that day to having learned to balance on ice skates when I was very young. Gradually, I became a die-hard cyclist, powering myself across the U.S. and 15 foreign countries. Yet despite all my riding, I still cannot U-turn instinctively. I slow, lower one foot, and push off the ground, as if on a scooter. Forget riding no hands. That's for guys who learned at age 5. I watch in awe as they unwrap a Powerball with both hands, keep pumping, and give as much thought to each as they do to breathing. Why push my granddaughter to ski? So she can know that ease. Just as I want her to dive in a graceful, effortless arc and bike no hands, I want her to dance around moguls and know she can control gravity. I want her to feel, in her bones, the confidence that comes to those who learn early. For now, though, I will be satisfied with a snowplow and a smiling face.
Susan Sabin spends her time cycling, writing, and grandparenting. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Kauffman, the Foundation of Entrepreneurship, celebrating entrepreneurs who start businesses and change the world, on the web at kauffman.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Controversy has plagued the Southeast Asia Games presently underway in Thailand. A dispute over the type of ball to be used in Sepak Takraw, a sport some have described as volleyball played with the feet, has led to the withdrawal of the Malaysian team. Further complicating the games, which are supposed to promote unity among the competing nations, is the bizarre behavior of the home country's bowling team. Malaysia and Indonesia have alleged that the Thai team locked their opponents out of the building containing the alleys and held a private practice session. "To lock us out is not very nice of them," said Malaysia's team manager, and who could argue with that? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Charlie Pierce's rocking rendition of a timeless Christmas classic in our 15th annual gift guide. But first, the very same Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I'll get you for this, Littlefield. I know where you sleep.
On Thursday, George Mitchell released the report that he and his commission had taken 20 months to prepare on performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. What do you make of this report and the recommendations?
Well, I think people misunderstood it from the start. It was originally designed, as probably should be no surprise to anyone, given the person running the investigation. It was organized as kind of a de facto congressional investigation where half the work is gumshoe work and the other half is recommendations going forward. I think, by and large, given the structural limitations of his investigation, no cooperation from the Players Association, no subpoena power, that the proposals going forward has got to make anybody in baseball happy, and that the gumshoe work was about as good as we could expect. A lot of names were mentioned that weren't involved in discussions of any kind about baseball in an awfully long time.
That's true, too.
Josias Manzanillo, who wrote a very heartwarming piece about when he was a rookie pitcher with the Red Sox and he liked it so much he got extra copies for his mom. I can't tell you how disillusioned I am to find him on the list.
At one point in Mitchell's Thursday press conference, he drew a parallel between his report on steroids in baseball and one of his past endeavors.
From my experience in Northern Ireland, I learned that letting go of the past and looking to the future is a very hard but necessary step to dealing with an ongoing problem. That's what baseball now needs.
Now, Mr. Mitchell won admiration from across the political divide in Northern Ireland for his work back in 1999 to boost the peace process there. Was the comparison a good one to make on Thursday?
I think it trivializes the great work he did in Northern Ireland. That should be obvious to any thinking person. But I do think that he is being unfairly criticized in a lot of quarters on a couple of levels. Number one, all of a sudden people who didn't really give a damn about standards of proof while the scandal unfolded are very, very involved with standards of proof because people like Roger Clemens' name have appeared. Where were you 3 or 4 years ago when those of us who were yelling about standards of proof were over in the corner of the room waving our hand and nobody was paying attention? Second of all, George Mitchell spent a lot of time being denigrated by baseball writers who basically can't carry his briefcase. This is a very serious man with very serious ideas, and I think that if baseball is going to survive this, and I don't think there's any question that it will do so along the lines he provided in his report.
Well, regarding the survival of baseball, I'm sure you're right. But is anything likely to change in baseball as a result of this report and what's likely to come after?
Well, apparently, if one believes the report, the steroids per se era of baseball has already come to a close with testing policy being in place and the use of steroids going down. I don't know what they're going to do about human growth hormones, but more to the point, there's nothing they can do. The operative phrase in this discussion will always be science marches on. And if they've developed a test for human growth hormones, there'll be something else out there. And there'll be something else out there. And the only real investigation into any of this has to be done by law enforcement. It's not going to be done by Major League Baseball.
On Wednesday, Andy Pettitte rejoined the Yankees, and Orioles shortstop Miguel Tejada became an Astro. I wonder whether there is some buyer's remorse in New York or Houston.
Well, I mean, let us not forget among people who are obtained and then appeared on the Mitchell Report list, Eric Gagne, who signed a $10 million deal with the Milwaukee Brewers last week. I don't want the drugs that Eric Gagne used to get well. I want the drugs he fed to the Brewers to give him $10 million. And Andy Pettitte, I mean, I tried very hard to tamp down the schadenfreude over the last few days.
I can see it coming.
But Andy Pettitte, committed Christian and former part-time television Bible salesman, getting shot full of human growth hormone or whatever in his redeemed keister in the Yankee clubhouse, that to me prompted a chuckle, and I cannot imagine how the Astros and Yankees feel today.
All this intrigue has apparently forced the current owners of the Chicago Cubs to sell the team to the state of Illinois. Have I got that right?
That's what it says. And we all know Wrigley Field, 93 years old, is going to be sold to the Illinois Sports Facilities Authority. Seems to be unclear how the state, which is in even worse financial shape than the Chicago Tribune Company is going to pay for buying the stadium. But apparently the Tribune Company is trying to sell the Cubs as part of a deal to take the Tribune Company private, and the transaction is supposed to close by the end of the year, but this is an entirely new spin on this.
It hardly seems possible.
Balls!
But in just 5 days, college football's bowl season will be underway, and what better place to start than with the San Diego County Credit Union Poinsettia Bowl?
Good Lord. I mean, what do they give out, like cheese graters and calendars to everybody who shows up at the game?
And credit.
The Credit Union Poinsettia. What's next, the Store 24 Bowl?
Anytime now. Seriously, as you look down the long list of bowl games, pick a few that nobody should miss.
Pick a few? Well, I don't think anyone should miss the R&L Carriers New Orleans Bowl myself. Kentucky and Florida State in the Gaylord Hotel's Music City Bowl. Well, I'm not going to use. You know what? I'm not going to use the sponsors. In the Music City Bowl, the Kentucky and Florida State ought to be enormously entertaining. Wisconsin-Tennessee in the Outback Bowl, another good one. And in the frustration versus we just hired a sleazy head coach bowl in the Cotton Bowl, Missouri and Arkansas is one that I would be very entertained by. And I think everybody who follows college football is going to be very interested in the Sugar Bowl because you've got Hawaii coming out of obscurity with a Heisman-contending quarterback against Georgia, who thinks it ought to be playing in the national championship game.
Do you realize how much underwriting money you've just lost us by failing to mention
major
corporations?
I'm sorry that I've wrecked our sponsorship deal with R&L Carriers.
Meanwhile, in pro football news, we learned this week that the Jets
have
been taping the Patriots last season. Do you suppose that's how they found out that the Patriots had been taping them?
I don't know. This is starting to get a little bit childish, isn't it? Can we just play the football game? The Jets stink.
That's the last thing the Jets want to do.
A very good point. They needed their version very badly. The Jets stink. The Patriots don't. It's going to be snowy, so it'll be 42-0 instead of 72-0.
Are you going to watch that game, or has the promise of carnage put you off?
Oh, no, the promise of carnage is what takes me to football. You know that.
The Atlanta Falcons lost star quarterback Michael Vick before the season even began, of course. Then they lost their head coach. He's gone. Is all this losing getting the team down?
No, apparently. Emmett Thomas, who's been an assistant coach for Atlanta since God was a boy, has ascended to the head job. Everybody seems to be very happy about that. There can't be anybody in America happier about the release of the Mitchell report than Bobby Petrino, who painted a giant bullseye on himself when he bolted the Falcons before the end of the year and called the Hogs in his press conference in Arkansas, thereby ensuring that D'Angelo Hall is going to come to his house once a year and throw bricks at his porch light.
I would suggest one other guy who might be very happy about the
Barry Bonds.
That's the man I had in mind.
There we go.
And finally, Charlie, you would think that a pie-eating contest would be a fairly straightforward event to stage, but the World Championship of Pie-Eating in London has hit a snag, unless they want to anoint a four-legged winner.
Hey, first of all, 10 pies eaten by Charlie, a dog.
Yes.
Not Charlie, your friend here, but Charlie, a dog. But not merely a dog. A Bichon Frise, which, in case you haven't noticed, is a
dog
doorstop. Is a dog who likes pies, but is also a dog the size of a doorstop.
Mm-hmm.
If you piled 10 pies on top of each other and they fell over, they would crush a Bichon Frise. This is a Bichon Frise who knows how to manja for the holidays. This is a tremendous pie-eating dog right here.
Maybe
and we don't have anywhere near enough tremendous pie-eating dogs here on Only a Game.
Maybe he should win.
Give him the trophy, which he would thereupon eat, probably.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
First I have a little treat. She gives me a little bite to eat. I chew and I pretend that I am eating peanut butter pie. Try as a peanut butter pie. If you don't think it's wonderful, I wanna know what. It'll stick to your mouth till you can't say hi. Try as a peanut butter pie. Try as a peanut butter pie. Oh, try as a peanut butter pie.
Should you still be looking for holiday gifts for the sports fans on your list, we're here to help with the Only a Game Sports Holiday Gift Guide, XV.
Come on and dance the Merry Christmas Polka. Let everyone be happy and gay.
You might want to consider an especially useful product decorated with the logo of the college or pro team of some lucky recipient's choice. Kevin Draws of the Memory Company hopes you will.
Well, it's a tin lunchbox, sort of a throwback from, childhood for those who remember carrying one of those to school. Young and old alike, college or pro enthusiasts will be proud to use this, whether in the lunchroom or, even taking it to work.
Now, in the photograph that I'm looking at, there's also what looks to be a salami and cheese sandwich and some delicious-looking muffins and an apple. Does that all come with?
Food and beverages not included.
Oh. John Youngblood of Guts and Glory Tennis is offering a food and beverages-related gift item, too. It's a very colorful little vest, which you can wrap around a bottle of wine. You get a bottleneck-sized sweatband, too, which is purely decorative. Useful is not the adjective that jumps to mind in connection with this item.
It has absolutely no purpose except for pure enjoyment. It's a folly item. I don't know that it actually makes the wine taste any better at all.
Well, I worry about one thing, though. Am I to assume that tennis fans aren't snobs? Because, some people buy wine to show off their taste, and you got to be able to see the label to know that somebody's got great taste in wine, and you got this little vest covering the label.
Oh, but tennis players are cheap. They're very cheap. If you find tennis balls for $2, you find tennis players lined up for miles to get them. So the fact that the butler covers up the label is actually an advantage in many cases.
Well, you can put anything under that.
Absolutely.
For fans of speed with less to spend, we've got another possibility, as long as the recipient of the gift enjoys romance novels set in the glitzy world of NASCAR. Pamela Britton is a prolific author of same. When we talked, I prevailed upon her to read the first few lines of her contribution to A NASCAR Holiday 2.
Oh my gosh, Mom, he is so hot. Maggie Taylor rested her fingertips on the steering wheel of her Ford Tempo, trying to ignore her daughter as she stared at the man who was, well, hot.
I like the fact that you laughed after three lines yourself.
Well, you know, it is kind of weird to read your own words. You know, I wrote that story well over a year ago, so mm-hmm. I will reread what I wrote, and I'll be like, that's a good line. That's pretty darn funny.
Though Ms. Britton's romance stories set in the world of NASCAR have sold well, she has learned that in at least one venue, they're unwelcome.
One driver said that if he caught any of his crew reading the books, they would be fired.
That wouldn't be good. So perhaps for the holidays, those pit crews and countless other fortunate people should receive Only a Game, my new book, which you can get by visiting onlyagame.org and clicking on the book, or by visiting a bookstore, or by...
Don't make me come in there.
Ah, it's our producer, Karen Given, who's a little anxious for me to get on to the next potential gift. In our ever-widening and ever-sillier search for sports-related gifts, during this Yuletide season, the Only a Game staff visited the Cambridge, Massachusetts headquarters of Harmonix, the creators of a new video game called Rock Band.
Hi, nice to meet
you. Thanks for having us.
You're welcome.
Adjoining the company's cavernous lunch area is a cluttered playroom that invites people like, well, like the Only a Game staff to indulge in their particular rock and roll fantasies, or, as the case may be, in their rock and roll nightmares.
So, where are the strings?
That's Only a Game producer Gabe O'Connor, who'd found a white plastic bass-like but stringless virtual instrument. Weekly commentator Charlie Pierce rifled through Rock Band's playlist of about 60 songs and grabbed the microphone.
Mississippi Queen! You know what I mean!
With yours truly on the electronic drums, Charlie howling the lyrics, Gabe on bass, and producer and former rock guitarist Gary Wallach also trying to figure out how to play without strings, the Mountain Classic went reasonably well. Until it didn't. We struggled to keep up with the lyrics, and the moving bass, guitar, and drum parts, represented by colorful moving lines on the gigantic flat-screen television.
Oh, no, what happened?
Song failed!
Song failed!
You're going to have to get a drummer who can keep time. It's obvious.
The word failed began flashing, followed by an argument between the virtual band members, who, it must be said, looked more the part than we did. A moment later, another message on the screen implied that Gabe, all 6 feet, 8 inches of him, hadn't been going all out.
Hey, you were hoarding your energy, dude.
I'm large. I can't help it.
It turns out that by playing his part more energetically, Gabe might have saved the rest of us from failing. In this game, if enough foam musicians fail utterly, the music stops, no matter how enthusiastically Charlie or anybody else is singing. Anyway, the first few songs we played encouraged us to seek an easier song. With Gabe still on bass, producer Karen Given on drums, and Gary doing his best Joey Ramone, we wrestled Blitzkrieg Bop into submission.
This one's harder. Not a clue. So bad. So bad.
Hey, oh.
Sorry.
Let's go. Hey, oh. Let's go. Finally in the back seat.
Get the microphone away from me. It's awful.
Failed again. I have no rhythm.
What are you doing?
Hey,
oh. Let's go.
I am not a drummer.
Let's go. Hey, oh.
Sorry, guys.
The idea here is that a group of people can learn to play together. Rock Band also can be a competition, either among the members of a band, say to see who fails first, or against another band. Though Dan Teasdale, a senior designer at Harmonix, says the holiday season has seen families embracing it for collaborative rather than competitive purposes.
We found that actually it draws a lot of people together. We heard a lot of reports at Thanksgiving of people bringing Rock Band to their families' homes and like putting it in front of like three generations of people and having them all come together and play as a band on like a whole range of rock songs. Having that as a unifying experience for your whole family playing music is just is an amazing feeling.
Assuming you already have an Xbox 360 or a PlayStation 2 or PlayStation 3, you can install the elements of Rock Band for about $450. Harmonix says it plans to offer more songs in the future, but just one word of caution. If you do it, stay away from Roxanne.
Roxanne! You don't have to boot on the red light. You don't have to boot on the red light. Boot on the red light. Boot on the red.
Oh. I think we blew up.
Could we maybe fade that under some Christmas music? Could we do that, please? Like right now? Thank you. Thank you very much. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to learn more about our 15th annual gift guide or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Only a Game's Gabe O'Connor, echoing the joyous strains of the season.
Song failed!
Song failed!
Well, maybe, but when you're having that much fun, can it possibly be called a failure? You want to hear Roxanne again? No, I didn't think so. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.